Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Podcast host Joe Moore from The Hidden Yardage, the story of the 1980 college football season podcast, joins us in the Pigpen to talk about that exciting, magical season of 1980, of all the players, coaches, and events that made it so special. We got Joe coming up in just a second to talk about this and more.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we have a great look into football history today through the portal, as we're going to go back some 40 years, I guess more than 40 years, and talk about the college football season of 1980 with a gentleman that has recently joined Sports History Network with his own podcast on that very season of college football. His name is Joe Moore. His podcast is named Hidden Yardage, the story of the 1980 college football season. We'll welcome him in now. Joe Moore, welcome to the Pigpen.
Darren, thanks so much. So happy to be here. So glad I have a chance to talk with you and all the football fans out there about 1980 college football season in my podcast.
Yeah, that is really an intriguing season, and I'm very pleased that you were able to come in, especially, and I'm going to let the audience in on a little secret here. Joe was just married days before we're recording this, and he's getting ready to go on his honeymoon. I think as soon as he hangs up the Zoom meeting with me, he's going. So we're going to consider the Pigpen as part of his honeymoon. Maybe his new bride will not appreciate that, but we're going to at least think that here.
Yeah. They're holding the plane back so I can finish talking about the season with you, Darren. But yeah, no, this is definitely just got married, still in that after wedding bliss right now. It's been a great weekend and kicking off with a great week and talking with you.
Well, congratulations to you and the missus, and we hope you have a great marriage and a long one, and enjoy this honeymoon because it's the best time of your life. So yeah. Please enjoy it. Well, Luke, why don't we get into a little bit about you and your football fandom? What got you to the point from, being a young person to having your own football history podcast? What happened in the middle there to support your football fandom?
Yeah. So it's a great question. So, for me, I grew up in Northeastern Pennsylvania, and I grew up in a Penn State house. So my dad went to Penn State, a lot of my friends went to Penn State. I ended up going to Penn State. And so college football was always kind of what we did on the weekends. And of course, Penn State's golden years were in the early mid 80s. And so growing up, I would pop in old VHS tapes with my grandfather, with my dad, and it would always be those classic Penn State teams. So I always loved that era of football and of college football of the early 80s. So as it were, I go to school, and I actually go to school for sportscasting. And so I'm a sportscaster for a couple of years. I'm doing mostly professional baseball. And then I decide I want to change. And so I end up going to school and becoming a pharmacist. But I always loved sports, always loved storytelling and those sorts of things. And so, a couple of years later, I'm out of pharmacy school. I'm living in Chicago. I'm working at a pharmacy here. And there were a couple of podcasts that I had heard that made me think, wow, if somebody were to turn this lens on college football and really do an investigative documentary type kind of serialized account of a football season, I bet that would be really interesting. At least it would be for me and anybody who liked football as much as I did. So from there, it became, okay, well, what am I going to talk about? What season am I going to talk about? How am I going to tell these stories? And because I love the early 80s, and because I knew a little bit about that going into it, I sort of zeroed in on 1980. And there was a couple of reasons for that. One, I thought it was a really interesting time in America's history because of what was going on in the government and what was going on in the country and internationally at that time. I thought that would be interesting to sort of tie that in and provide some context for the season. But more importantly, on the field, what was going on in college football? If you look at the 16 years before 1980, there was only one first-time national champion, and that was Nebraska when they won the title at the beginning of the 1970s. The rest of the time was just the same old teams handing the title back and forth to one another. It was Notre Dame, Alabama, Oklahoma, USC, kind of all the blue bloods doing that. But in 1980, Georgia wins the national title, and it's the first of five straight first-time national champions. They finally get some new blood in there, new programs to win a title. And I said, that can't be a coincidence. Something must have been happening in this era. And sure enough, I dug into it a little bit more, and you see that they had the scholarship limitations that were voted on in 1973. They take effect in 1978. And then you also have the college football powers that be wrestling control of television rights away from the networks and putting it back onto the schools, which now means that it's not up to the networks who gets on television. The schools have more say about getting their name out there and getting publicity. And so, of course, that opens up the opportunity for them to make more money because they're now on television and make themselves more attractive to recruits. And so you see from what was this concentration of talent and power for just maybe 8 or 12 programs, now it's starting to get spread out a little bit more throughout all of college football. And I think that's why we started to see new teams start to win the title starting in 1980. And then the last piece was just the incredible personalities that were playing at that time, both coaches and players. I know we're going to get into that a little bit, but it's really just a who's who, not just in college football history, but in professional football history, when you look up and down the rosters of some of these teams in 1980.
Yeah, there's some of the greatest stars of generations, I think, came out of that. They were playing college football in that 1980 season. And just to add something onto that, do you find now 1980 was, you're right, it's really interesting. And did you find that you sort of have a clash of offensive schemes at that time too? You still have, you know, like Joe Paterno's and Bear Bryant's are still coaching. And there's still the use. I think Nebraska was probably still using, you know, the power eye, and Oklahoma might have still been using the wishbone, but you have these new offenses coming in that, you know, gentlemen like, you know, Bill Walsh had introduced, you know, in the late 70s, you know, with the West Coast and things like that are coming on. And you have this mix mash of just your different eras colliding. And I think that really adds to the flavor of 1980. And that's such a very, very intriguing season that you picked for the topic of your podcast.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So you definitely had sort of the what they call the 8 yards in the cloud of AstroTurf. You had all those big eight schools running the wishbone and the power eye, Switzer's teams and Osborne's teams. But you're so right. You start to see passing offense take hold. And again, it was pretty much because these smaller schools said, we can't just line up and out physical these other schools. We can't just play them straight up. We have to figure out a way for us to get an advantage. And what that was going to the air. And so just like you mentioned, you see guys like Mouse Davis, who was this really innovative coach with the run and shoot offense. He's out there at Portland State University with Neil Lomax. Neil Lomax would set 90 records in his college career. They would beat teams 105-0 during the 1980 season. Then you also have, you have slingers like Mark Herman for Purdue, who's thrown and setting all-time records. And you've got Dave Wilson at Illinois, who's setting single game records against Ohio State. So you really are seeing this. And in 1982, actually, that was the first year that a team would win the national championship by throwing for more yards than they ran for. And so 80 is kind of right on the cusp there. Lavelle Edwards with Jim McMahon, they're throwing the ball everywhere. And then as you're getting kind of towards the mid 80s, when passing offense really kind of becomes the fad in college football. So you're totally right. There was a sea change going on, and there were some brilliant, innovative minds coming into college football. And as always, then that, of course, would be borrowed and taken by the NFL. And then you'd see passing offense always a couple of years after whatever you see happen in college.
You know, it's very reminiscent, almost scary how it's almost a deja vu. If you go back probably 60 years before that, back to like 1920-ish era, and you have almost the same thing. You have like the old guard of football, the, you know, the Ivy League schools we know them as today, you know, the Penns and Yales and Harvards, and you have these new coaching styles coming up, you know, like Pop Warner and you know, some other gentlemen, Jock Sutherland, some of these guys coming up with these new schemes for football, and it really changed the game then too, and put it on a, you know, slingshotted it into a new arc of a game. And I think you really have a similar story some 40 years ago in that 1980s season, in those early 80s, doing that same thing like you're saying here. So it's very interesting, the parallels.
Yeah, and I think that's a sort of, you know, it's a trend in college football. You see this, it's sort of very cyclical because, you know, teams will, they'll kind of get a stranglehold on power. And then eventually the teams that don't have the power get a little bit fed up with it and they have to get innovative. They have to try something different. And I think you even saw that if you, you know, you went backwards 60 years, you can go forward 30 years and you can see what was happening with Chip Kelly and the way that they started to do the spread offense in college football and Urban Meyer's spread option and all these teams that started to go to the spread and they started to really punish these teams that had been stocking up on big, bulky, run-stuffing guys and had all the muscle up front. And then, of course, again, you see that sort of kind of slip and bleed into the NFL, where now every NFL team has some kind of spread option package.
Yeah, everybody wants to run RPO now, right?
Yep, so, absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah, that's it's, I didn't even think about that in today's era. You're right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your bio. I got to talk about this first.
Okay.
In your bio on Sports History Network, reading over it here, and you talk about, you know, being going to Penn State in journalism, the pharmacy degree, like you said, and then you throw this little zinger at the end that you perform comedy around the city of Chicago.
Yes. Don't ask me to tell a joke, though, Darren. I don't do that. I moved to Chicago from North Carolina in part because I wanted to perform more. So I was doing some comedy in North Carolina. And, you know, Chicago has such a great live comedy scene that I decided to come out here and take some classes. So I went through the writing program and the acting program at some of the schools around here, like Second City and that. And then, you know, I had a writing group and we would get together and we'd write comedy and then put it up on stage. And I've done some stand-up around the city. I've acted some small parts and some short films and student films and things like that. So it's, I don't do it as much as I want to, because unfortunately I've got a full-time pharmacy job that keeps me from doing all those fun things, but I try and stay busy with it. And I love it. You know, I love to perform. And I think the podcast is probably an extension of that. It's a chance, you know, I just love to tell stories and it's a chance for me to do that the way that I enjoy telling them. And for me, I'm happy that those stories are out there. They're available now on the Sports History Network, and you know, they're going to be preserved for people. And this story really is an evergreen, right? You can go back to the 1980 college football season, and I think it's interesting whether you're telling the story in 1981 or you're telling it in 2022. It doesn't really matter. I think that story is always going to be interesting. And so I'm really happy that I've been able to tell it. And I've got, you know, the way I did it was one episode per week of the season so that you could sort of follow along and understand what was happening and how one week kind of built to the next and the next and the next. And so I'm actually putting the finishing touches on another episode right now, and then I've got two more left. And so we're kind of getting right into the bowl season right now, and then we're going to wrap it up with what's going to happen for the race for the Heisman Trophy, what's going to happen for the race for the national title. And I know it's no secret. I know most people that are going to be listening to this already know who won the national title. It was Georgia. They already know who won the Heisman Trophy. It was George Rogers. But what I was able to do was talk to a lot of these players and coaches and media that covered it that season and get some of that inside story, some of the little relationships and connections that maybe you didn't already know about if you hadn't studied this season as deeply as I have. And I think that's why I called it Hidden Yardage, was because for me, this is sort of between the numbers, right? I don't think that I'm going to be shocking anybody with the score of these games or what's happening, but it's kind of what happened in between and how these players and these people interacted with one another and how we got to where we all know we got to with Georgia winning its first ever national title. I think that's what's interesting.
Yeah. And like you said, they're the national champions right now, the reigning champions too. So they had their first one back then.
You
know,
yep.
Now, the one I guess we're going to do as our main subject line tonight, as we discussed, is we're going to, you know, we talk a lot about the different levels of football, high school, college, and a lot of the professional leagues here in Pigskin Dispatch. And we'd like to sort of marry that up and talk about some of these very interesting players from the 1980 season and sort of where they went, because we had, besides the NFL, we had, you know, the CFL going strong. The USFL is in there somewhere. So some of these gentlemen are, I know, showed up in there as big stars. And it's really an interesting time. And I count, by my quick count, I see the 1981 NFL draft. There are seven Hall of Famers right in the first round that, we're in that draft. So it's a very significant draft.
You're absolutely right. So the 81 draft had a total of eight Hall of Famers. That's tied for the most ever with the 1983 draft, which means that all of those players all played in 1980. And so between the 81 and the 83 draft class, you've got 16 Hall of Famers, 23 total Hall of Famers that played their careers kind of at some time crossed over that 1980 season. There's so much talent there. You talked about the USFL. There's players that got drafted to the USFL, Jim Kelly, Steve Young, Reggie White, Gary Zimmerman, all those guys played in 1980. And then of course, 19 Hall of Famers that got drafted into the NFL. And I mean, again, these aren't just Hall of Fame players, which is crazy to say. These are some of the greatest players ever. Eight of the NFL's 100 all-time players all played in 1980. And if you look at the All-American teams that CBS and ESPN announced for the 150th anniversary of college football a couple of years ago, they listed a total of 51 players out there on that team, on both of their first teams. 11 of them played from 1980. That was the most of any year. And so it's just an aberration of the talent, particularly quarterbacks and defensive talent that played in 1980. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's like you said, there's even some of these names that aren't Hall of Famers in the Pro Football Hall of Fame that are very recognizable. Like you were talking about, you know, the Heisman Trophy winner, George Rogers, you know, went number one to the New Orleans Saints. Mm-hmm. And he's, I mean, very significant player. Everybody, I mean, you're much younger than I am, and you've heard of him. And yep. He's a very, very strong running back for Georgia.
Yeah. And you know, Mark,
South
Carolina. Yeah. Mark May, who was the Outland Trophy winner in 1980 for Pittsburgh, a three-time All-American. And he played all those great years for the Hogs and the Washington football team. So, I mean, he's not in the Hall of Fame. He's in the College Football Hall of Fame, but not the Pro Football Hall of Fame, but he's another great name. And Darren, I just want to highlight the 1980 Pitt Panthers team, because, you know, I went to Penn State, so I don't like to often give credit to Pitt, but I have to for the program that they had built there. In 1979,
that's fine, because this the Pig Pen is in Western Pennsylvania, so that's okay. We can talk about Pitt.
Okay, great. So in 1979, they go 11-1. In 1980, they go 11-1. 1981, they go 11-1, right? So that is 33-3 over 3 years. They don't ever win the national championship any of those 3 years. They win a couple of the computer polls. They win the New York Times poll, but they don't actually ever get the AP or the coaches poll. But listen to this roster from 1980. 17 of their 24 starters go on to start in the NFL. And then they had five backups that went on to start in the NFL, seven others that play in the NFL, five make their way into the College Football Hall of Fame, and four make their way into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And their entire offensive line and defensive line started in the NFL from that year. I mean, that team, coached by Jackie Sherrill, had so much talent. We know Russ Grimm, Mark May, you know, they've got Frelick was on that team. And then you've got on the defensive side, Hugh Green at one end, Ricky Jackson at the other end. I mean, there was just so many good players on the Pitt team. It's incredible that they never got over the hump. Of course, Dan Marino is one of the most recognizable names from that squad. They never got over the hump and won a title, but you can't tell the story of early 80s college football without the Pitt Panthers.
Yeah. And this is four seasons removed from Tony Dorsett and the great 76 team.
Yep.
So yeah, I didn't realize that over the 3 year span, I guess I'd never thought about that, but I definitely remember watching them. They were one of my teams that I watched, but I didn't realize 33-3. That is pretty impressive when you look at it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, something else I'm still looking at this 1981 NFL draft. Mm-hmm. And something that really jumps out at me is that the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, mm-hmm. has two players selected in the top five. I mean, that's
right.
That's phenomenal. You have Freeman McNeil and Kenny Easley, both going in the top five. And you don't see that as often anymore, but it just shows you how many powerhouse teams there were. And the Pac 10 back then was a very strong conference itself, besides,
Not only that, you're so right. I mean, it was a strong conference. You had USC that year had a 28-game unbeaten streak snapped towards the end of that season. But if you look at the Pac-10 in that 1980 season, so there's a preseason academic scandal. Half of the teams are ineligible. So both schools from Oregon, UCLA, USC, and Washington State are all ineligible to win the conference title or play in the Rose Bowl. And of course, guys like Freeman McNeil, guys like Kenny Easley, they're upset because they knew they were coming back with a pretty good football team. And now they're getting robbed of their chance to represent their school in Pasadena. So one interesting story about that. So they had, UCLA had played Ohio State in the Rose Bowl in 1979, when Ohio State was undefeated and ranked number one going into the Rose Bowl. And on their run to the Rose Bowl, Ohio State came from behind and up and beat UCLA on the road. And the return game was in the Horseshoe in 1980. And UCLA, of course, had already realized that it couldn't reach its goal of the Rose Bowl, but it could play spoiler against a really good Ohio State team that was the preseason number one. And in that game, they actually beat Ohio State in Columbus, give Ohio State its first loss of the season. But remarkably, Kenny Easley gets thrown out of that football game because on the sidelines, he got into a fight with a local photographer from Columbus, punched him in the face. The referee saw it and threw him out. And in the game, and afterwards, he was unapologetic after the game because he was still so wound up because that team played with such an edge. They had something to prove. Of course, they would have their chance to climb the number one in the polls, but they would get upset by Arizona. And lose their shot at playing spoiler and finishing the year undefeated. But yeah, Kenny Easley is a really, really interesting guy.
But what's with it with the Horseshoe and his punches on the sideline in that 5-6 year period? Are we had Woody Hayes, 7-4 right. Doing the same thing?
Yeah, yeah. Woody Hayes' last game against Clemson when he threw the punch. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, but that game was such a surprise reading about that UCLA team and Kenny Easley and McNeil. I mean, they were so good. And you're right, like that West Coast football in the Pac-10, those USC teams were incredible. John Robinson, of course, their head coach, who then would leave college to go to the NFL and coach the Rams. And he's still, believe it or not, the winningest coach all time for the Rams. He has 79. Sean McVay's hot on his heels with 62. So he's probably going to pass him at some point. But even right now, John Robinson's still the all-time wins leader for the LA Rams. But yeah, there's just so much talent. I mean, and we're talking about coaches. You know, if you look at the 13 winningest coaches in major college football history, the eight of the top 13 coached in 1980. And those were, you know, Paterno and Bowden and Bear Bryant and Schembechler, like some of the real big time Mount Rushmore names of college coaching.
Wow. I guess I didn't really think about that too, but yeah, you're right. You had, actually Joe Pa was sort of right in the middle of his career there in 1980.
Yep. And yeah.
He started what, early 60s?
Yeah. I think 66 was 66. His first year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the further I went, like the more I dug and looked for interesting stories, you know, it seemed like they were just everywhere. And again, that was part of it, which is the personalities that were in there. You know, reading these post-game interviews with Bo Schembechler, you know, I was able to call Jackie Sherrill and talk with Jackie Sherrill on the phone about what it was like to coach that Pitt team and how aggressive they were. And I mean, there's just, again, like it was a different era of football. I mean, I know now coaches are, they're kind of getting towards where they're untouchable again. They're the CEOs of these multi-billion-dollar industry of college football. But back then it was different. It was still sort of regional. There were still these sort of, you know, fiefdoms, and you had these different coaches that sort of ruled over their area. And I can't tell you how many players I talked to that wanted to tell me a Bear Bryant recruiting story. And they would tell me about how Bear Bryant would come into their house. He would talk to their parents, talk to them. The one player from Florida State told me that Bear Bryant put his hat on the back of his couch. And then when he sat down, the hat fell on the ground. And the player said that his mother jumped up and ran over to pick the hat up like it was the two stone tablets of the Ten Commandments, because she couldn't believe that Bear Bryant's hat had fallen on her dirty floor. And I mean, it was just, you know, there was just such respect and reverence and awe of these coaches. And it was just a different era. And so hearing them, the way they talk and the way that they would go into players' houses and recruit them, you know, Woody Hayes going into a player's house and taking off his Rose Bowl ring really slowly, sliding it across the table and saying, if you want to win one of those, you've got to come to Columbus. And the player told me, he said, that was it. I was hooked. I wasn't going to go anywhere else. And the way these coaches just held court was incredible.
Yeah, I think, you know, so those are some of the greatest recruiters of all time. And I think college coaching, even today, I think they might be some of the greatest salesmen of all time. You know, they're making a lot more money than he would be selling any product they would do, but selling their programs is just unbelievable. And you just see some of the talent that some of these gentlemen are collecting for their schools. It's unbelievable.
It really is.
Yeah. So I guess what we wanted to do is really get into like a few handful of players from that 1980 season to see where they went and what they did in their 1980 season. And maybe we could chat about some of those. And
yeah, definitely. Okay. I mean, I think, you know, for me, you talked about the draft class there in 81. Of course, number one is George Rogers from South Carolina. Number two, though, everybody knows about, that's Lawrence Taylor. And so Taylor, you know, from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, or playing in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, he gets drafted second overall to the Giants and goes on to have just a remarkable career. I mean, he's one of, I think, two players ever, along with Alan Page, to ever win regular season MVP as a defensive player. And Taylor, of course, did that in the 80s, playing for Parcells and those great New York Giants defenses. But, you know, Taylor was part of that defensive class. And I think, you know, he goes to the Giants, and really the Giants were in this huge rebuilding period, right? They had kind of had their magical run. And I think in the early 60s, like 63 was probably the last good team, with Y.A. Tittle losing to the Chicago Bears. Then they kind of go dormant for like the entire 1970s. The only thing you know about the Giants is the miracle at the Meadowlands when Joe Pisarcik fumbles and the Eagles run it in. And then, you know, Parcells comes in, he starts to build the team. And I think he really did it with defense. And you're looking at players, again, like Lawrence Taylor, and they, of course, go on to win those two Super Bowls. I mean, I think, you know, you can start and end any conversation about the greatest player in NFL history with Lawrence Taylor, certainly on the defensive side of the ball. And, you know, and he was the same way in college. I mean, they wreaked havoc in college. They had, you know, he took North Carolina to bowl games. He had them undefeated and ranked in the top five. You know, he was winning games. He beat Clemson almost single-handedly. He beat Texas Tech single-handedly. I mean, he was, you know, causing fumbles, making interceptions, sacking quarterbacks before they even kept that as a stat in college. So, I mean, Taylor was, he was a terror in college, and then of course went on and was even better in the pros.
Yeah, he definitely a great player. And we did a series on the greatest players at each number. We went 0 through 99 in the NFL. Mm-hmm. And you know, Taylor was definitely, you know, number one for his jersey number. But I'm wondering, now you attended Chapel Hill for postgraduate for your pharmacy school, correct?
Yeah, I did. I absolutely did.
Now, did they have like statues of LT around campus or by the football field or?
So the stadium's, it's pretty cool down there in Chapel Hill. So you can go to the stadium and you can walk around. If you're, you know, cutting from class to the other side of campus, you could actually just walk right through the stadium. And inside the stadium, sort of at all the different portals that lead you into the different entryways to get to your seat, they have all the classic players there. And so Taylor definitely has a prominent position. You see, he wore 98 in college. So there he is with his 98 on. He had the full beard back in 1980 that he wore. And so, you know, before he had the LT dangly earring hanging on there, but they have the headshot of him up there. There's no statue to Taylor that I remember seeing in Carolina. And it's a shame. I don't even know how many people at UNC even remembered their football history or knew that Taylor went there, because they're so basketball crazy down there. But it was one of the first places I went. I ran down to their football office and I went and looked in their trophy case. I wanted to see what I could see about Taylor from 1980. So he's remembered down there, but probably doesn't get the respect that he actually deserves.
Okay. Yeah. I was wondering if it was like a, you know, a Red Grange situation, you know, University of Illinois, they have, you know, statue of Grange out in front of the stadium and
yeah,
like that. But maybe a different era, statues are overrated now, maybe. So
now they are. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
But a good placard and a jersey hanging up on the wall, that's pretty good too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, Taylor is just one of them from that year. I think other players, you know, just looking at the sort of, again, on the defensive side of the ball is unbelievable. You know, you look at a guy like Mike Singletary at Baylor, you know, Singletary, of course, again, another one of the great linebackers of the 80s with the Chicago Bears. But then Ronnie Lott with USC. And I mean, and I talked to some guys that played for the other USC, for South Carolina, because they actually played out in the Coliseum against Southern Cal in the beginning of that 1980 season. And I asked them, what was it like to play against Ronnie Lott? And they all said that nobody hit harder than Ronnie Lott. You know, they saw him on film and they said, well, there's no way he's going to hit that hard in person. And then the couple of guys that were unlucky enough to take his helmet to their chest realized quickly that he was not messing around out there. And, you know, Lott is another one of those mythical guys on those great 49er teams. You know, everybody knows a story about him cutting off part of his finger to get back into the game. I mean, just intensity personified. And he's on all the lists you can read about greatest safeties of all time, both in college and the pros. Ronnie Lott's up there. And to think, you know, he, again, playing in that 1980 season for one of the greatest teams of that era, for those USC, those Southern Cal teams that had other great pros, like Anthony Munoz was on that team as well. Marcus Allen, Charles White. I mean, just so much talent in that 1980 team.
Yeah, he really reinvigorated that position of safety, especially in the NFL, really put the word, emphasized the word strong and strong safety, because like I said, he was a thumper and he punished you if you came into the hole.
Yeah,
sort of invented that sort of box safety role, I think that we call it today. But yeah, he was pretty good in pass coverage too.
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. He was, I think you associate him, you know, those Niner teams, people think about Taylor and Rice and Craig and Rathman and Montana, but that defensive side of the ball too, especially with Ronnie Lott. I mean, that's a big reason why, even with the West Coast offense and Walsh and Seifert at coach, you know, those were still so formidable as a defense, because Lott was back there as the quarterback on that side of the ball. But, you know, that takes us to quarterbacks, and you can't talk about the 1980 season without talking about quarterbacks. I mean, out in Stanford, you've got John Elway, who, even though he'd win 2 Super Bowls and play in a bunch more in the NFL, never played in a bowl game ever in college. Of course, probably the most famous game he played in was the game against Cal with the band is on the field. So that he played against them when he was a senior in 82. You know, Dan Marino at Pitt was a sophomore in 1980. And Marino was a great story, because Marino was a guy who grew up in Pittsburgh, and right around the corner from Panther Stadium. And Hugh Green, the great linebacker on that Pitt team, used to tell me that after practice, he just walked down, he called Dan Marino's mom, you know, he called her mama Marino. He'd go in there and she'd cook him some spaghetti so he had something to eat while he was in college. And, you know, and it was just, he was one of those guys that just grew up in the shadow of Pitt Stadium and was able to go there and, you know, be one of the best players in America. And then of course you got Jim Kelly, who played down in Miami, but again, another Pennsylvania guy. And the famous story about Kelly was, of course, Joe Paterno recruited him, but Joe Paterno said, well, I've already got my quarterback, so how would you like to be a linebacker? And Jim Kelly calls his older brother and he says, I don't know, what do you think? Like, I always want to go to Penn State, but Joe wants to make me a linebacker. And his older brother told him, when you walk on an airplane, no one wants to know the name of the linebacker. They all want to know the name of the quarterback. And so Kelly said, well, that's it. So then he called Howard Schnellenberger, headed down to South Beach at Miami, and started that tradition of quarterback U at Miami. He was the first one and really laid the foundation for Miami to go on their run. They'd win a national title in 1983. Bernie Kosar, Vinny Testaverde, Steve Walsh, Ken Dorsey, and on and on and on. So, but Kelly was started all that. And all three of those guys, Elway, Marino, and Kelly, they all played in that 1980 season. And of course, Kelly was the only one that went to the USFL before then finding his way back to Buffalo, where he had, you know, some of the greatest years ever in the late 80s and early 90s with that run and shoot offense and Marv Levy.
Yeah, you say that, and I wasn't even thinking the quarterbacks, but you're right. They were underclassmen, except for Elway. Yeah. But, you know, even when I look at this draft 1981, the quarterbacks aren't what jump out at me. It's the running backs and the linebackers, you know, that do it. But you're right. Those are some of the greatest quarterbacks of all time. And how many, you know, Super Bowls have been played in just those three names that you talked about? It's probably in double digits if you combine them all together, I'm sure.
Yeah, I bet it is. And it goes back to what you were saying. Like, it's a change in football philosophy in that era, because, you know, if those guys had played 10 years earlier, they probably wouldn't have been as famous, because they're just, the style of play was different. You know, the guys that were playing at that era were, you know, they're essentially running backs that were just the best ball handlers on the team. But I mean, but now finally you're looking for somebody that can go deep, that could air it out, throw the ball, you know, and lead a passing offense. And those are three of the best right there, Elway, Marino, and Kelly, at doing that.
Yeah, I think, and I'm sitting there thinking, I was probably, I was seventh or eighth grade in this 1980 season. So I'm really intense in watching football, but I grew up watching football in the early 70s and throughout the 70s, you know, Western Pennsylvania, of course, there was a pretty good team going on at that time in professional level. So we were always geared in Penn State, and, you know, that was thrown in us, but that was, you know, play, you know, solid defense, especially with your linebackers, and run the ball, you know, with some good running backs. That's the keys to that, and have the guys in the trenches that are going to, you know, do the damage on both sides. And then you get into this era where you have, you know, Marino and, you know, Elway, the gunslinger, and Kelly, you know, this with his fast pace of play, that they're just throwing the ball all over the yard. And I think if I remember back, it was kind of confusing to watch. You're like, going, what the hell are these guys doing? You know, this isn't football. What are they doing? And it's sort of, you know, at least from my own perspective, I think a lot of the people that lived in the area I do, we didn't appreciate what they were doing at that time until, you know, years later when you see, you know, the results that they were having. So it's another very intriguing part of the season.
Yeah. And I think what you said is perfect because you're talking about watching football in Pennsylvania growing up, and there's a certain attitude that comes with football in that part of the country. And you're right. Like, to throw the football everywhere is, you know, that's anathema to that steel curtain and that, you know, ground and pound and possession football that, you know, is what people played back there. And with college football, I think you see that highlighted because college football at this era, at least that we're talking about 1980, was still very much a regional sport. And so you could throw the ball out west and you really wouldn't be questioned for it. But if you tried to bring that into the Big Ten, then all of a sudden you're going to get all these sort of side-eyed views looking at you like, what are you trying to do? This isn't how we play football. Same thing down in the SEC. No one's trying to do that in the SEC. They're trying to play physical, wishbone football, the Big Eight, all those conferences. And so you're right. Like, the same kind of football played in two different parts of the country are going to get a completely different kind of reaction. And I think that that's still true to some point today. But I think now, again, everybody has sort of, like you talked about earlier, everybody's got some kind of RPO in there. Everybody's sort of seeing the benefit of the spread offense. And it's sort of hard to hang on to those identities that had been around for decades at the time that we're talking about. But in 1980s, when you start to see this passing offense become the fad.
Yep. Okay. That's a great, great point. Now I'm going to ask you a question, and I'm going to have you have your own personal opinion here, and you can't have a wrong answer, but let's say you have somebody that's totally unfamiliar with football and you have an hour to talk to them and you want to tell them about this 1980 season. Who's the first player you're going to tell them about from the 1980 season? Because you've got some real gems to talk about.
Wow. I think I'd have to start with Herschel Walker, because I think the story of Herschel Walker then allows you to tell the story of the Georgia Bulldogs. And they, of course, are the centerpiece of that 1980 season. And I think that when I thought about the season a lot, Georgia was not the best team that year. As a matter of fact, I don't think there really was an all-time great team. I mean, Pitt was probably the best team that year, but Georgia survived. Georgia was the last undefeated team, and they had lived a charmed life in 1980. They had so many close calls against Tennessee, against Notre Dame in the Sugar Bowl. They had another close call against Clemson at home, a close call against South Carolina, and so on. And I mean, every week it seemed like they were just, you know, snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. So I think I'd start with Herschel Walker, because to read about this player's recruitment even, and think about everything that happened there. So here's one quick story about how crazy people were about Herschel Walker. Everybody wanted this guy. And the University of Georgia goes and sends some people out to Herschel Walker to try and see if he wants to come to Georgia. And at the time, you know, Herschel was one of a bunch of kids that grew up in his family, and he was really competitive with his older sister. And they used to always race each other. And Herschel always remembers the first day that he beat his sister running down their dirt road. And when Herschel was young, there was a horse. I think their family had a horse. He used to race the horse, is how he used to try and get faster. Anyway, so he's racing his sister. He finally beats her. And he realizes that, you know, okay, I'm doing something here. I'm onto something, because he had so much respect and love for his sister. And she was a great athlete too. Anyway, Georgia comes calling, and they're talking to George. They're talking to Herschel, and he says, "Well, you know, I'd really like to be able to go to school where my sister goes to school." And you know, and they say, "Okay, well, where does she want to go?" And he says, "Well, she doesn't want to go to Georgia because you don't have a track and field team for girls there." And so, wouldn't you know, within a year, Georgia has started a track and field program just for girls so that Herschel's sister could go there. And then, of course, Herschel goes to Georgia. And he's always been kind of evasive about how he made that decision. Sometimes he just says he prayed on it. Sometimes he says it was a flip of a coin. Sometimes he says it was best 2 out of 3. Other times say it was just, you know, he made a snap decision at that moment and just put the phone call into Georgia. So he's never really said why he's done it. But I don't doubt that had something to do with it.
Well, whoever was the athletic director at Georgia at that period in time, they should be athletic director of the century, because that was one of the wisest choices ever to start that track team for the young ladies to get his sister there. Wow.
Yeah.
That is a cool story.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think you have to just, I think I have to start with Herschel Walker. He was in, you know, as a freshman that year. And I think now, you know, certainly with Tim Tebow, Johnny Manziel, and, you know, we've seen freshmen come in and just do incredible things. That was not the case back then. You had some coaches like Joe Paterno that just never wanted to play freshmen, thought freshmen should always sit, you know, kind of learn the offense, wait their turn. A guy like Tom Osborne, I talked to all these players at Nebraska, that was sort of what you did. You came in as a freshman, you watched the seniors play, you lifted weights, you waited your turn. And then when you were a senior, they turned you loose and you had one shot, or maybe two if you got to play as a junior, to win a national title for Nebraska. But here's Herschel Walker, comes in as a freshman, was listed third on the depth chart when they go to play Tennessee, first game of the year. And by the end of that game, Herschel Walker is the starter, and there's no question about it. And of course, all year he was sort of neck and neck with George Rogers. Who's going to win the Heisman? Rogers was the senior, the guy who was kind of just unstoppable. I heard one of the newspapers described him as animated concrete, which I thought was just a fantastic nickname. He ran so hard, nobody wanted to get in front of him. And Herschel Walker had just that incredible sprinter speed, and he was going to bust one big one at least every game. And they had a great duel, and they actually got to play each other on the field between the hedges in Sanford. It was a huge game, top 15 national television between George Rogers and Herschel Walker. And Herschel got the better of him. Herschel outdueled him, rushed for more yards. They won the game. Rogers had a pretty important fumble at the end of that game that kind of gave it to the Bulldogs. But still, Rogers ended up taking home the hardware. And I think at that time, it was just, you weren't going to give the Heisman to a freshman. But I think if you're watching games from 1980, like I spent so much time doing, he's the one guy that just jumps off the screen at you as saying, this guy's just at another level athletically. And to think that he's doing that all as a freshman makes it all that more special.
Yeah. And I guess as a important side note, he's been on the news lately for some political aspirations, and the guy's mid 50s now. He still looks like he's cut enough that he could probably don the pads and gain a lot of yardage for whoever he played for. So dude's in shape for his age.
He is. You're so right. I've definitely seen some pictures of him. And then he had that stint with mixed martial arts a couple years ago too, when he was in his 40s, and he looked the same way. The guy was just shredded.
Now, wasn't he the one that said he never lifted a weight, and it was all push-ups and sit-ups and body weight?
Yeah. I found a couple like paperback books about him, and I think most of them are apocryphal, just filled with legends. But you're totally right. Like every night he would do something like, you know, 1,000 sit-ups, 500 push-ups, and a couple of squats or a couple hundred squats or something like that. But you're right, it was all supposed to be.
I don't know if I've done 1,000 sit-ups in my lifetime, let alone one evening. You know, geez.
Yeah, right. But yeah, no, he like, you know, apparently was just chiseled from granite by a lightning bolt or something like that, is the way that I think people in that part of the country like to tell the legend of Herschel. But I mean, what a story for him to come to Georgia and to win their first national title, and for him to just be, you know, he had so many memorable moments that year. And then, you know, he goes on, he's another player, right? Goes to the USFL. And then of course comes to the NFL, and he's involved in that huge trade between the Vikings and the Cowboys, where I can't remember if it was 10 players or 11 or however many it were to trade to him. And he bounced all around the NFC East. I remember he played for the Eagles. He actually made his way to the Giants. He almost played for every single team in the NFC East before the time his career was done.
Yeah. What was wrong with Washington? Why didn't they
right? Yeah. Who knows?
Well, Joe, you know, this is some fascinating stuff, a great subject matter for your podcast. Why don't you let the listeners know where they can hear you at?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's Hidden Yardage Podcast, Story of the 1980 College Football Season. It's anywhere that you can get your podcast. So, you know, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, anywhere you get your podcasts. I do have a social media presence. I'm actually not terribly active on it. I really just post when there's a new episode that comes out, but you know, I do post some pictures and things on there that that might be fun to look at if you're going to be listening to the episode. So that's just at Hidden Yardage Podcast on Instagram and at Twitter, and then the website hiddenyardagepodcast.com. I kind of have transcripts of the shows there, and I have some of the sources that I used for this, some of the different books that I thought had some of the most interesting stories about that season and biographies of the players and the coaches. So yeah, I mean, if you're interested, in that 1980 season, I do my best to sort of tell these kinds of stories. I don't spend a lot of time recapping the game and talking about, you know, this a runoff tackle for 5 yards or a 20-yard pass down the left sideline. It's really more of kind of coloring in between the lines and sort of showing the different the ways, the stories of how these teams all came together and these players did and how they sort of fit with what was happening in America at that time. And so there's a 14 episodes, so one for every week, including the bowl season. And so you can start in the beginning and just go through the whole season as if you were back in 1980.
Well, definitely sounds intriguing. We'll have some of those links on the show notes to get your listeners right to Joe and his social media presence. And you can also find it on Sports History Network. Joe, I appreciate your time, especially this busy time in your life. So I'll let you finish packing and go. You love that young bride of yours. Take a couple weeks off and enjoy life. And we'll have you hitting it at it here probably in a few weeks. So yeah. Appreciate you.
I will, Darren. Thanks so much. And I know my wife is happy to have a break from having to listen about the 1980 season too for a little while. So I'll give her a break as well.
Well, have her download some of your episodes, listen to it on the plane or something.
That's it. Good advice.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
All right. Thanks, Darren.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.